The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show. So, where are we all at today with the roller coaster? Well, there's a very interesting poll in the Sunday Business Post. And look, we'll take all the caveats, it's an opinion poll, etc., etc. But just in terms of a rough snapshot maybe of where people are at, 86% of people think that people travelling to Ireland should have to quarantine in a hotel at their own expense for 14 days. 85% would take the current and new vaccines if they're shown to be safe and effective. Pubs and restaurants should not reopen until most of the population have been vaccinated. 70% say they agree with that. 56% of people think schools should reopen in February if cases continue to decline at current rates. And the figure, interestingly, is kind of similar for parents of school children. It's roughly 2-1 among parents of school children think the school should reopen in February. So it's 59-31. And then it's kind of half and half on the government is doing a good job at rolling out vaccines as quickly as possible. 46% say they are, 47% say they're not. I suppose, you know, we always would have said on this show that the nightmare scenario is that there are vaccines here and we're not rolling them out. So far, when the vaccines come, they are getting them into people's arms, but that could become a lot more challenging in coming months as more and more come, but we will see. The Business Post leading with government scrambles to contain fallout from Brussels border blunder. Simon Coveney says the Northern Ireland protocol has been damaged by controversy, and it certainly has the Brexiteers and all kinds of people taking the opportunity now to open that Pandora's box again. And you know the way 85% of people would take the vaccines? We are mad for vaccines here, so much so, according to the front of the Sunday Times, that vaccine hopefuls are trying their luck in the north. So it's cross-border vaccine shopping. People were heading up, seeing if they could get inoculated at a community facility in Northern Ireland. But it's been scuppered now because you would need an NHS registration number to get it. So they're been so. Don't, if you were thinking of heading up north looking for a vaccine, don't do it. They've got more details in the Sunday Times on the new travel restrictions coming in. Gardaí will turn back drivers 5 km from the border. And also they're saying holidaymakers returning from overseas could face fines of up to €500 as they leave the airport. They also say in there, by the way, that so they're talking about City West Hotel being one of the mandatory detention centres, or whatever you want to call them, mandatory quarantine centres. Private security firms will police the quarantine rules in hotels. And I know that, I think that's the situation in some countries, but you got to think what could possibly go wrong there. The Sunday Independent revealed Holohan warning on weak border controls. So there's a lot of texts and emails here between Tony Holohan and the Health Minister, and we're sure they have an excellent working relationship as well. I shouldn't be laughing, but there's a very funny text here. On October the 22nd, Holohan texted Donnelly to inform him the R number for Dublin had gone up to between 1.2 and 1.3, and Donnelly responded with a thumbs up emoji. The Irish Mail on Sunday, family sues over hospital COVID deaths, so they're expecting that some patients who got the virus in hospital, which is a lot of people have been in recent weeks, might sue. But then legal experts seem to say inside it would be very difficult to prove exactly where you got it. You would also need to prove that the staff hadn't followed procedures, and that, you know, that it would be very unfair on staff who are doing a very difficult job, and that public policy would endeavour to protect them. Sunday World, I'm glad Monster Brothers in jail. Brave survivor waives anonymity to tell how she was abused as a child. The Irish Sun on Sunday, Kinahan on the ropes. Crime boss Daniel Kinahan is claiming to be a legitimate businessman ahead of a BBC expose. I always think when you're having to tell people that you're a legitimate businessman that you're losing straight away there. The front of the Mirror, has a lavish wedding with at least 12 people in the bridal party in St. John's Church in Tralee, County Kerry. And it was a young traveller couple, and people are annoyed about it over a breach of COVID guidelines. And we did see traveller leaders yesterday out again, really pleading with the members of their community to stick by the COVID guidelines in terms of stuff like funerals and weddings and so forth. And just, I'll just read you the front of the Sunday Telegraph. They're actually, they're loving this, like this whole European cock up and their own stellar vaccination program. And today, Britain ready to help out EU on vaccines. So they're taking the Tory press are taking the high moral ground there, and we'll help out the poor Europeans. Now, my panel today, Sam McConkie is the head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the RCSI. Colette Brown is an Irish independent columnist and barrister, and Paul Somerville is the CEO of Somerville Advisory Markets. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Before we start, we just put, hi Sam, will you just put on your headphones for a minute, please? And we're going to go back to that story on the front of the Sunday Independent. Hugh O'Connell, you have that story today in the Sunday Independent, and you have seen emails and texts between Chief Medical Officer Tony Holohan and Health Minister Stephen Donnelly from last kind of October, November. And I suppose what you would get from it is that there is a fairly tense relationship here, at times tetchy, and people not getting, well, the minister not getting back always. The email that makes the headline is Tony Holohan's warning that the weakness of Ireland's border controls meant it was not protected from importing new strains. This was in November. Tell us about that, and tell us about the response from the minister.
Just to give you a bit of context around this, Brendan, this was back in early November, around November 5th, 6th and 7th, when there was a new strain of COVID-19 had emerged in mink that was discovered was transmissible to humans. And this had happened in Denmark, and the Danish government announced that they were going to cull 17 million mink. So this prompted a response in Ireland, and the text messages and emails released to us under Freedom of Information, and which we published extensively today, show some of the exchanges that Stephen Donnelly had with his Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holohan, at the time, wherein Tony Holohan basically went back to NPHET's long-held concerns about overseas travel and gave a pretty stark and strident warning about the weakness of Ireland's border controls. So this had been prompted by the discussion around the situation in Denmark. Donnelly had emailed the CMO and his officials asking them to, as a matter of urgency, engage directly with their counterparts in the UK and Northern Ireland, noting the decidedly more robust position in the UK, which had banned all travel from Denmark and was asking people to quarantine for up to 14 days if they were coming in from Denmark, and imposing fines if they didn't. Dr. Holohan sent a response. This was on Saturday, November 7th, at 9 p.m. that evening, basically saying that we discussed this yesterday. We have a good understanding of the UK decision, and the various government departments in charge of this and the HSC have the measures in place which you have been briefed on. And in concluding that email, he gave a very stark warning, and this, to my mind, is more strident than he had been publicly at the time, and arguably has been publicly at any time. He said, our COVID border control measures do not give assurance to me as Chief Medical Officer, and as a result provide me no basis for assuring you as Minister for Health that we have appropriate public health controls in place to protect Ireland from importation of this disease. This is particularly concerning now that such a potentially serious development as mutation may be has arisen. Now, this is weeks before we subsequently confirm that a different strain of the virus, a new mutant strain, B117, the Kent strain, this more transmissible strain of the virus, was in Ireland. So here is the Chief Medical Officer giving a very clear warning to the Minister for Health about the weakness of our border controls. And the Minister's response the following day, Sunday, November 8th, was pretty terse, in which he said it would have been useful if you had aired your concerns, or indeed any concerns whatsoever, in regard to border controls when asked for your view at the Cabinet Subcommittee some weeks ago, where the border control protocols were being discussed and agreed. And that was at a time when the meeting to which he refers is when the Cabinet was discussing, the Cabinet Subcommittee was discussing the EU traffic light system that was subsequently imposed across the EU, various countries designated green, red, orange, and so on. Most of the countries are deep red now, I think. And Holohan wrote back and said, well, actually, I did. I've been raising these concerns since last summer. We also have concerns about one-off tests and how we can be satisfied as to their validity as a basis for people coming in from red and green countries or red and orange countries, setting aside the requirement to restrict their movements for 14 days. And he said that he had articulated these concerns at the Cabinet Committee meeting and they've been raised subsequently.
So, look, what we're getting here, Hugh, is that, like, this was fairly robust, you wouldn't call it hostile, but it was robust relationship between them, more robust than we were seeing in public at that point. There's a text from October. This is 5 days after the government rejected infamously the public health advice to lock down for 6 weeks. And tell me about, Tony Holohan texts the minister and then what happened? So tell me what tell me about that exchange.
Yeah, so as you said, about 10 a.m. Saturday, October 10th, 5 days after the government had rejected the public health advice to lock down for 6 weeks, Holohan texted Stephen Donnelly. He said, Minister, case number is well up today. And he went on to detail figures he'd been given by the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, reporting 1,011 new cases. And this was the first time in 6 months that Ireland was reporting over 1,000 new cases in a single day. And it was well above the 617 cases that had been reported the previous day. And indeed, that week, cases had hovered between kind of 300, 500, 600. But here we have 1,000 new cases. This would be made public later on that day. Holohan told the minister that he and his public health officials would be looking at these numbers in more detail over the course of the day. He gave him a breakdown of where case numbers, where the highest case numbers were, and said he was available to discuss this if he wished. Donnelly didn't text back. 7 hours later, the CMO texted the minister again. He said, Minister, grateful if we could have a word finalising statement re-cases. This was the statement that he would issue later that day with the usual daily publication of the case numbers. And it's not clear whether Stephen Donnelly spoke to Tony Holohan that day at all. And his spokesman told me yesterday that it was not possible to source at this point the telephone records for that day. So I suppose it's concerning in a sense that, you know, it doesn't appear, at least as far as we know so far, that the minister, having been alerted to this sharp rise in new cases, sought to discuss the issue with his chief advisor on the pandemic.
Yeah, no, look, Hugh, I know that you've been assured that they have a very good and excellent professional working relationship and all that. There are other texts as well. We won't go into all of it. People can read them in the Sunday Independent. Your overview on it would be that it does seem tetchy.
Testy, I would say, strained at times. Just the degree to which there doesn't seem to be that strong working relationship that you might expect on the evidence of the emails and the texts. And as you said, Mr. Donnelly's spokesperson has characterised their relationship as excellent and says they regularly talk in person, social distance, I'm sure, and over the phone. And no doubt that is the case. And I mean, a lot of the text message exchanges that were released do record daily interactions on various issues that had arisen over the course of October and November. Donnelly looking for Holohan's input in terms of the EU health minister meeting that he was attending. But there are certain things which would indicate that, you know, Dr. Holohan was uncomfortable perhaps with some of the public health messaging that Donnelly had been delivering in around case numbers in Dublin in October. That's detailed in the story today. And also expressing reservations about a proposal from Donnelly that they would hold meetings with public representatives from certain electoral areas where compliance with COVID measures and case numbers were not going down. And that, I suppose, is indicative of two men who are not exactly on the same page on a lot of issues.
And look, let's be fair to them as well and say that people are going to have disagreements about how to approach stuff and people throw out ideas and someone else says, no, from my perspective, not a good idea. OK, Hugh, will you stay with us for a minute? I want to talk to the panel about it. Colette, you were looking at this story as well. What do you make of it?
I thought it was very interesting because it allows you peer behind the kind of public relationship to see what's going on in private and to see the real tenor and tone of the exchanges. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that they do appear to be strained. Now, Mr. Donnelly is in obviously quite a high pressure job at the moment, to put it extremely mildly. And actually, there's debate in some of the papers today about his yeah. performance
in
that role. But you know, I think the text messages that have been unearthed by the Sunday Independent today, I think they pose a lot of problems for the government, because here we have a clear warning from Tolly Holohan about the danger of variants. Now, it was in relation to mink in Denmark, yeah. but he was issuing that warning at the start of November. This is before, as Hugh has said, that the English variant, the British yeah. variant, had arrived on these shores. And one would have to say, if they had introduced measures, more comprehensive measures at that time in response to those calls from NPHET, would we have experienced the kind of surge that we did over December and into January,
which yeah, and look, I think
as we remember, let's but I mean, yeah. which has resulted in over 1,000 deaths in January yeah. alone.
And look, May, June, NPHET were saying this as well, and they're, you know, Simon Harris was told back then as well that they weren't happy about
But I think that the timing here is very significant, because in May and June, obviously the cases went down, and we did have a period where there were low numbers of cases before they ratcheted it up again. Okay. But I think the timing,
this is more damning.
The timing of the warning here is very important.
Okay, Sam McConkie, what did you make of it? Sam?
As we've just heard, it does give us an insight into how decisions are made in government. We have to ask, is this the best way to make them? And it exposes that we don't have a national population preventive executive coordinated group in our country who have a multi-point strategy. Rather than having a major strategic approach to fix this COVID problem, we've got isolated discussions about one thing or another.
We have a cabinet subcommittee, and we have a NPHET. What else do we need?
So I would suggest a population preventive health executive, meaning a command and control structure whereby people and resources are mobilised for, you know, 15 or 20 different ways of keeping COVID down once we get it down. At present, our testing's done in one place, our contact tracing's done by somebody else, everything's done by different groups of people who are not centrally coordinated.
Okay, yeah. And of course, that would be contingent on us as well having a properly functioning and adequate public health system around the country as well, you would imagine, which we apparently don't have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it is, you know, back in the 50s, we had a really good public health system controlling TV, but it's been kind of run down over the last 20 or 30 years. And we just have to acknowledge, compared to many other countries, we don't have a robust preventive health. I hate using the word public health, because some people think of that as just the taxpayers funded curative health service. But what I mean is population prevention, how to prevent disease and keep us healthy rather than to cure people who are sick. And there's much more to it than foreign travel. The focus on foreign travel that we've been listening to, it can be dangerous, because it can lead to just sort of xenophobia, blame the foreigners, keep the foreigners out, and that doesn't really solve a complex international pandemic type problem like this. All infectious disease, whether it's HIV or herpes or flu, everyone blames the foreigners, and that's not a good solution. It doesn't help you. So we have to work with people of all nationalities to fix this together, and it's much more than keeping out travel. There's, as I said, 15 or 20 things that I would put in a national strategy to keep COVID down. But I'm delighted it shows that Tony Holohan realises you can't sit with 200 or 300 or 400 cases of this every day, because it just will come back and bite you. You have to get the numbers really low and then put in place the structures to keep it down.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I keep thinking of a really interesting interview Leo Varadkar gave earlier in the month, just in terms of the way he broke it down. He said that we can be very tempted, what you say about foreign travel there, to think of things in binary fashion, that if we had done one thing, everything would be fine. And then he listed off the five things, which, like, I won't bore people with them now, but they were, you know, hospitality, home visits, traveling around the country, people coming home, and then non-compliance. And he said, you know, so it was a mix of things, but it speaks to what you're saying there about somebody looking at all those issues together, maybe. Paul Somerville, you were looking at the Matt Cooper on the back of the Business Post is asking, is the health portfolio just too much for Stephen Donnelly? And I don't think it's entirely personal. He's saying maybe it'd be too much for any one person.
Yeah, first of all, just back to your previous comments, I think that story is an absolute non-story. Nobody cares about the relationship between NPHET and Stephen Donnelly and what they're texting and what they're not texting. It's absolutely irrelevant, their relationship. And it just shows you how we go down sort of little stories that make no sense whatsoever. The problem here is the Irish border has been porous all the way along. We have not tackled the airport for one situation. We have not tackled the border in the north. And our government policy all the way along was to keep that border porous. So saying that NEFID texted Stephen Donnelly and Stephen Donnelly texted someone back, it's totally irrelevant. We made the decision, our government made the decision to let people fly in through the airport all the way through the summer, after the summer. Their reasons for doing that are unclear, but that is the policy of the government. So when
surely it's useful to highlight that there have been regular warnings from public health specialists advising the government to put in extra controls on traffic, and they have been ignored at almost every turn until very recently. I mean, that's important journalism.
But you don't need to be an expert from NEFID to say our borders have been porous. So then we go on to the article you're referring to, Matt Cooper, talking about Stephen Donnelly. Is he up to the job as health minister? Now, for me, if you take this crisis as a whole, there's three crises going on simultaneously. We have the financial crisis, which is our unemployment, our small businesses have been absolutely decimated. We've got the education crisis, obviously, with our schools closed. And then we've got the health crisis. Now, to me, it's very clear that one of those subjects hasn't been talked about at all. And there's a reason why. And that's the financial crisis. Mm. And the reason...
It's almost as if we've parked it, isn't it,
for now? No, we haven't parked it. The reason is because there's two very competent people running the departments. Pascal O'Donoghue and Michael McGrath have done an excellent job in running the crisis in the financial. So there's nothing much to talk about. Now, they have announced policies. Now, I don't agree with all the policies. Nobody does. But they've announced a very clear plan and everybody has gone along with that plan. So everybody, it's a cohesive strategy and they're doing an excellent job. When you get to the health system and you get to the education, it's headless chicken stuff all the way along. And it's the reason being is because you've got two ministers that were picked who have no ministerial experience at all.
Yeah, no, in fairness, now you'd have to say we were doing a fairly good job on education.
I don't agree whatsoever.
Things went completely out of control in the last couple of months.
The only decision that had to be made on education was the Leaving Cert. And we were assured that the Leaving Cert will go well and marking the Leaving Cert last year would go well. And it was a shambles.
Was it a shambles, though? Looking back, yes. How many problems have actually arisen out of it in the long term?
Well, if
everyone seems to be largely happy. Anyone who wasn't happy did their SATAN exam.
Well, if you speak to the young people that missed out on grades and missed out on college places, I think they would disagree. But let's just take when Norma Foley announced that she was opening the special schools only 3 weeks ago and she forgot to talk to the teachers. You know, the teachers' unions came out within hours and said, you hadn't consulted us. So what I'm saying is it's the lack of experience.
What happened 2 weeks ago, the most recent one, was the unions were on board. And I think everyone agrees the unions were then blindsided by their own members after that webinar.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that analysis.
Well, I think everyone accepts that's what happened.
What I'm getting at is it's very clear that when the government was formed, they picked two very experienced or inexperienced people to take these portfolios. And I think that was a very bad mistake. Now, it's nothing personally against Stephen Donnelly or Norma Foley. I think they will become very good ministers in time. But it's very clear when you look at the financial situation and you look at those two situations, look at the absolute gulf in difference. And that is because we have very experienced politicians handling finance and we have very inexperienced politicians handling education and we have and health.
You could say that health is a much more complex one at the moment.
Obviously, it's a very, very difficult job.
Does everyone agree with that, or would anyone like to defend the Minister for Health?
Well, look, just to, a defence, purely to say that obviously it's a hugely difficult job and it's the most difficult job in government at any time, never mind when you're dealing with a global pandemic. So the amount of pressure, obviously, that Stephen Donnelly is under is immense.
So and I think Angola and then he got to take over Angola with a nuclear bomb dropped on it, essentially.
Exactly. And I think the point about him being a first-time minister, I mean, that is a valid point. Obviously, it takes some time to settle in if you've never done a job before. I think what's often forgotten, actually, we have three junior ministers in health. We have Anne Rabbit, she's Minister for Children, Equality and Disability, Mary Butler, Mental Health and Older People, and there's Frank Fian, who's Public Health, Wellbeing and National Drug Strategy. So where are they at the moment, you know? Because, you know, they haven't been out front and centre. You'd imagine, you know, the junior minister for Public Health, he could have a job to do here. Mary Butler, the Minister for Older People, obviously, with what's going on in care homes and things, surely there's a role there.
I have heard her out
I'm talking about care homes, but, and I mean, she seems very engaged about it, I must say. I'm not going to sit here defending all
roles. I mean, when the new government came to power, they appointed 20 junior ministers, the highest number since Bertie Ahern in 2007. We have a lot of ministers in this government. You know, there are people there who could maybe assist Stephen Donnelly if he is under pressure, and I think nobody would doubt that he is under pressure at the moment. And there have been a number of gaffes. There has been an element of overpromising and under-delivering. I would say, in their defence, the vaccine rollout in Ireland has been quite good relative to other European countries, and I think maybe people don't appreciate that. And I think the supply issues that we are going to experience with the vaccine, largely they're not the fault of the government here. There's a European context, obviously, for that.
Sam, do you think if we had a different Minister for Health, we could be in a different place?
If I could come in.
Yeah.
I don't see it as primarily a ministerial problem. It's that we don't have national capacity for preventive medicine at national level. We haven't built that over the last 30 years, which was my earlier point. And whereas we do have very good, you know, cardiologists if you need a stent, and very good diagnostic tools and good access to drugs and a lot of other good things about our healthcare. Obstetrics is fantastic here. But our preventive health has historically lagged behind in terms of staffing, structure, quality.
Okay.
And that's really we've struggled for the last year because of that.
We have that. Hugh, would you like to defend yourself, your journalism, the minister, anything from the machine gun attack there from Paul Somerville before you go?
Look, I'm sorry the poll doesn't like the story, but it's actually Pascal Donoghue, not Pascal O'Donoghue, as we refer to him. And as for his comments in relation to the only decision Norma Foley had to make was about the leaving certs, I mean, what about closing and reopening schools? What about remote learning? What about special needs schools, junior cert, mocks? I could go on.
So do you think Norma Foley has done a good job then, given the circumstances?
Well, I mean, I just think it's fairly glib for him to claim that the only decision that she had to make on education is the leaving cert. I mean, that's patently not true.
OK, Paul Somerville, I'll give you 30 seconds my there. Point, you're being glib.
My point is a simple one. Making a big story about who texted what and what the reaction was is an absolute non-story. We are in the middle of a global pandemic.
I'm really sorry you don't like the story, Paul, but lots of other people appreciate that it's important to get an insight into what two of the men responsible for responding to this pandemic, who have chief responsibility for responding to this pandemic, what their discussions are behind the scenes. So that's why we put our story today. And I absolutely stand over it on its merit.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hugh O'Connell, thanks a million. I'll see you. Guys, let's move on to the kind of elephant in the room aspect of this then, which we've got. It's in that story. It's in a lot of it. But obviously, zero COVID and the whole notion of it growing and growing in momentum all the time. And we see there that if you take it that mandatory quarantine is a big element of zero COVID, we see there that people definitely, there is a clamour out there among people for this mandatory quarantine. I suppose, Sam, you're the expert. Let's go to you first. You are largely zero COVID-y, are you?
Yes, because I can't see that the alternatives in any way work. We've learned in December that if you have 200 or 300 cases every day and you open things up, it just comes back in a terrible, horrible way. And I think everyone was shocked by that. So the problem is that while zero COVID isn't a nice strategy, there's nothing better that I can see. The vaccines, unfortunately, we've now all realised they're not going to come for several months or years. Two, we don't know how long they last for. Three, they may not prevent transmission. And four, they may not be effective against new variants. And they may not work in the elderly and immunocompromised so well. So this idea that the vaccines are going to sort of completely fix this, which some people had in October, November, you know, is just a false idea.
So I don't think it's what I'm hearing there.
Control of borders, there's a lot more to it.
Okay, yeah, I know that, but it is one of the key aspects of it. I understand there's more to it. But one thing I would say is what I'm hearing there is, which is one of the kind of, I think, worries that people have, is that you're saying that we could be stuck in a zero COVID kind of strategy for much longer than we think. So to cut off internationally and then and everything else involved in zero COVID.
Yeah, I think at a leadership level, as me and found out when he did the smoking ban, multiple other countries rapidly followed him. So were we successful and able to open up as the first country in Europe to do that, many other countries would choose the same plan, perhaps Britain, and then you can start to open up with that country for essentially free travel with other zero COVID countries.
Yeah, of course, the dream would be, and you see, like France saying we're not taking any foreign travellers from outside the EU. In one way, it's a kind of a scary thing, the idea of a fortress Europe. But in another way, it certainly would suit everybody's lives at the moment. Paul Somerville, where do you stand on this so-called zero COVID?
Well, there's an article, I think it's in the Sunday Times today, and it's "Why Can't Ireland Be More Like New Zealand on COVID?" And when you read the article, you realise we just can't be like New Zealand. You know, we are much more porous country, much more people coming in and out and to do a trade. But what we can have is a maximum suppression strategy. For an example, New Zealand have only had 25 deaths in the whole crisis. We just had 1,000 deaths in January. I mean, we are in an absolute tsunami of problems here. And for me, I just don't see the maximum suppression strategy being put into fashion in the best way. So I still think what we're looking for is basic competency. I'm not looking for you know, a zero COVID policy. And again, I would say this is a discussion that you can go down a rabbit hole on. Yeah. We just can't have zero COVID. But what we can have is the best thing we can, which is basic competency. If we do the simple things correctly, we should be able to get the cases down quicker.
Yeah, and there does. I think there's a continuum now there where essentially what NPHET want, a lot of people are saying, is ultimately zero COVID. The government are kind of saying, look, we're not calling it zero COVID, but we are going maximum suppression, which is similar.
But are they? You see, I kind of break out into a cold sweat when I hear Leo Varadkar say things like we're going to get down to the low hundreds of cases and wait until there's approximately 50 people in ICU units and then we're going to open up. And I wonder, you know, am I suffering from deja vu, but or have we already tried that and did it end in disaster, you know, over Christmas when the cases
learned one thing here is that we never learn, isn't it? Every time it's bad, we're going, oh, we'll never do anything again. And then it gets good again and we go, oh, we're fine.
But I mean, to say something that so obviously reveals the fact that you've learned nothing, you know.
Well, I think vaccination is the difference.
The CDC had an announcement on Friday and they've cautioned that previously their estimation was that you'd need 70% of the population to have received a vaccine to reach a threshold within society so the virus would not circulate freely. But with all of these variants now that have much higher transmissibility, and even there's some evidence that the British variant may have a higher mortality rate, that actually you'd need 80 to 85% of the population to be inoculated before you'd reach that threshold. So things are getting harder, things are getting more dangerous, things are getting more precarious, and I think people around the country want the government to take much stronger measures to protect public health and also to protect the economy, because what we've learned is that there is no workable, functional economy until the public health issue is sorted out. And it's crucial that that's done. And I think one of the most interesting things actually in the opinion poll in the Business Post today was that 70% of people do not want pubs and restaurants to reopen until a majority of the population is vaccinated. And that's in stark contrast, I think, to similar opinion polls that were taken last year, because people have learned from the disaster that happened over December when hospitality was opened up in winter time when everybody was packed inside. And, you know, you can wash your hands and you can wipe down spaces, but it's an airborne virus that's transmitted when people are close together in an indoor environment that isn't well ventilated. People have learned that lesson. Can the government now please also learn that lesson?
Paul, from the economic end of things, can we afford to stay shut down like this until everybody is vaccinated? And can we afford, indeed, as Colette says, what people want, which is to shut down harder? Can we keep...
Yes, we can afford it.
Keep the economy going, yeah?
It's very clear that we will be borrowing a hell of a lot of money. So will every other country. And that's what you have to do in a crisis. So it's very clear. Interest rates are very low at the moment. The reason the ECB is backing us. The reason our interest rates are very low is because of central bank policy across Europe. It has nothing to do with how our economy is run. That is going to be there for many, many years to come. So we need to borrow money at this moment in time to stem, you know, and help the economy. I think it's very clear from public opinion what they would like to do, if possible, would be to open the schools in some fashion over the next couple of months, if it was at all possible. And they're prepared to sacrifice the hospitality and other industries for that goal. So I would suggest that maybe getting the schools open would be the first priority. And then as the vaccines roll out, obviously, maybe towards the summer, we would have a better chance of opening up some type of business. You know, by the way, this week, there's very good news on vaccines. You know, so there's a lot of good vaccines coming down the track, huge quantities. You know, so it is a good news story for later in the year. But I think public opinion is way ahead of the government here, which is saying that,
be patient
in general, but open schools if you can, but be patient on all the other aspects of it.
I think the danger is the government is going to come under huge pressure once all the vulnerable groups in the country are vaccinated, it'll start again,
the clamour. Like.
And I think it's going to be very, very dangerous if they succumb to that pressure. People will argue that
lockdowns were to protect the health service and to protect vulnerable people from dying. And they say that's off the table now. So the calculus changes.
Yeah. And what you have are a number of epidemiologists all around the globe warning that if you leave the virus run out of control in any demographic. So if it's under 65, you know, and particularly given the kind of variants that we have at the moment with the higher transmissibility rates, it's inevitably going to lead to overcrowded hospitals, increased mortality rates and deaths, except those deaths are going to be occurring in younger people because more of those younger people are going to get this disease.
Yeah, and you know, I saw more medics in the UK last night at Sky News or somewhere, but basically saying, look, whatever you're being told, we're seeing younger people and we're seeing sicker people this time. And you do keep hearing that kind of...
And it was a feature it was a feature of the surge over December and January here that there were an increasing number of younger people in ICUs around the country.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot, Sam. Oh. Yeah, okay. So in terms of then, look, there's lots and lots of strands to this. So in terms of what happened over the last few days then and this whole kind of, I suppose, vaccine wars, if you want to call them that, Paul Somerville, you were looking at a piece that Lucinda Creighton has in the Business Post, Error After Error Compounds the EU AstraZeneca Debacle.
Yeah, Lucinda has a very, very good article just explaining very simply what has gone on here. And basically what it is just a monumental cock-up is basically as she explains it. And unfortunately what has happened then is politics has got in the way of it. So, you know, the European politicians have to be seen to be going after AstraZeneca, and especially because of Brexit. So, you know, for example, it's not just in this country. All over Europe, they're reporting on this case and saying how EU have really done a bad job. I think in La Paz in Spain, they said it's a total humiliation, they said yesterday. You know, in France, they're saying Brexit won, EU zero. And this is because what's happened here is, obviously, the British are being a little bit smug in the sense of they have rolled out their vaccine and got their vaccine quicker than the European community. There is an argument now with AstraZeneca about where they're producing the drugs. And then we have this strategy from the EU, which I would believe is totally the wrong strategy, to shut down AstraZeneca from exporting. And Lucinda Creighton, I think, says it very, very well is in her article, which is basically you're just compounding the problem by bringing in things like this. And then what happened, obviously, on Friday was the Northern Ireland Protocol was brought in on the back of this, which was a monumental mistake on the back of the original mistake. But again, you know, back to say Hugh O'Connell, and maybe he took offence to what I was saying about his article, so he shouldn't take it personally. But what I'd say about this story is pretty similar, which is I believe this story will be gone in a couple of weeks because it's all about AstraZeneca and why and where those vaccines are, the numbers of vaccines are coming. They're under pressure because one of their factories aren't producing enough of those vaccines. And basically the EU is saying, well, we want some of the British ones. And AstraZeneca is going, no chance.
Yeah, but are they the British ones? Like those British factories were included in AstraZeneca is a multinational pharma company.
Well, obviously, Colette would have an opinion on that. That's for legal minds to decide. But what I'm saying is the strategy of going out in the public and slagging off AstraZeneca in the middle of a global pandemic, I don't think is a very good one.
Yeah, I would have thought what they were more doing, Colette, was that like,
I heard somebody saying, look, there's no point in them getting involved with a long protracted legal case. What they want is the vaccines now.
Of course.
They're basically just showing some muscle. Like,
yeah.
I mean, this whole notion of we're going to publish the contract so that like people like me on radio shows who know nothing can kind of say, well, this is what I read in the contract.
Well,
and
it wasn't
in
even
fairness, there were legal experts on as well. But like,
but
it's a showmanship, isn't it?
But I found it quite bizarre, actually, because, you know, they seem to be so eager to publish the contract as if it was going to be game, set and match then once people saw it. And what you saw was a division of legal opinion, then some people in AstraZeneca's camp and some people in the European camp, because, I mean, you can have different interpretations of one contract, and obviously it would be for a court to decide, a Belgian court in this instance, you know, the correct interpretation. And obviously, you know, you can't wade into a months-long, years-long legal battle over this when people want the vaccine. So what this is a political dispute, not a contractual dispute. Ultimately, and what the European Commission was trying to do was strong arm AstraZeneca to apply pressure to force them to kind of kowtow to their demands. And obviously, I think that they went too hard, and it hasn't worked. And ultimately, what's going to have to happen here is there's going to have to be a negotiation, and there's going to have to be give on both sides if the European Commission really does want to get an increased number of vaccines. And it's vital that it does for the rollout all over the block. And I think there is a point in a lot of the coverage today that's querying, you know, Ursula van der Leyen and indeed the health commissioner, the European health commissioner, who basically are overseeing this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, responsibility, they have to take responsibility for what's going on. And, you know, the rollout in the US has been much faster. The rollout in the UK after Brexit and all has been much faster. And the rollout, it's going at a relative snail's pace in the European Union. They took over control of the vaccine program for the European countries, and they have serious questions to answer about the way that it's going now.
Yeah, Sam, you would hope that Paul Somerville is right and this will all be forgotten in a few weeks, but is this just a taste of what's to come? Like, that the vaccine situation is going to be divisive, there's going to be, you know, nationalism around about it, or supranationalism in terms of the EU, and that also is the big message we're getting here, is that the EU has cocked this up.
I think that wisdom will prevail, and most people involved will realise that what I call a nationalistic bun fight is not going to advance anybody's situation very much, because vaccinology and distribution is a worldwide issue. AstraZeneca is a Swedish and a British company. The components for these vaccines come from an integrated international supply chain that's all involving often 5 or 8 different countries all over Europe and in the US. And that's true for many of the other vaccines as well. I'm hoping optimistically that when we've 8 or 10 vaccines approved in 3 or 4 months, that the companies will be able to manufacture them enough to meet the demand. The challenge is inevitable. We've 8 billion people, Brenton, on the world, and we all need 2 doses. That's 16 billion doses. And you just can't make 16 billion doses of these vaccines over a few weeks. So inevitably, there's going to be not just competition, but even fighting. And that's what we're seeing, is fighting over these doses. And I think the wisdom will prevail and realise that, as I said, fighting too much is counterproductive, because we need each other. Europe needs Britain, Britain needs Europe through all this.
Mm-hmm. And Britain is assuring Europe they're there to help. Sam, there was a kind of curious in a way piece in the Financial Times this weekend, but the fact that it was in the Financial Times, possibly you would say, well, maybe we should be taking this semi-seriously, and I know you looked at it, and this is the notion that the pandemic is burning itself out in India, which is a very attractive notion, almost as attractive as zero COVID, get our lives back, that it might just burn itself out.
So the data coming out of India in the last few weeks is that there are fewer deaths and fewer cases in their hospitals now than a few months ago. They were completely overwhelmed, both socially and sort of almost ethnically. There was a lot of political tension and conflict, but also the healthcare system was swamped, whereas now things are improving. And people are asking, why is this? It's also been a feature in Africa, where I've worked for years, that there haven't been as many deaths and illnesses in Africa as people would expect it. There are a number of reasons for this. One is that people are younger in India and Africa. So we know this is a disease of more older people and more death in older people. So maybe the younger population sort of distribution affected. But it seems that the impact and the benefit is more than can be explained just by youth age alone. So there's another idea that almost like, I don't know if you heard the hygiene hypothesis, like you get your children to sort of eat mud and eat clay and it improves their immune system, they don't get asthma. There's an idea that maybe in Africa and India, where people have more exposure to other viruses and other diseases, and the environment generally actually helps them to survive and respond stronger and better
okay.
to COVID-19 and SARS-2 than we do here. Maybe here we're all cooped up in a clean environment. And it may be that there are other factors that they're not counting the cases as well. So I think it's a really interesting story and keeps a world perspective on this rather than a parochial one in our own little county.
Yeah. And does it give you hope? I mean, and again, like this is an idiotic layman's thing, but you read it's burning itself out. Can that happen? Like,
well, all epidemics come and go. The challenge, Brendan, is that if you just let it run through this population here in Ireland, you probably know in my misery, you predicted over 100,000 deaths if you did nothing about it. Now, that's the cost, that you've just chaos and overwhelming the healthcare system and a lot of death to let it burn itself out. And then maybe people would get COVID 6 months or a year later. It might come back again. But yes, all epidemics, you know, 30 years ago, we'd HIV as a massive problem. Now we've got good drugs that control it and it's a control problem. So, and you know, we're not worried about cholera and plague and so on. So I'm sure there will be better times, but at what cost? If it's 100,000 deaths in Ireland, that's not a satisfactory public policy option.
Okay.
You have to find an alternative.
It seems my strident defending of the government and all the ministers against that onslaught from the panel earlier was not enough. A spokesman for the Taoiseach has contacted us to say that as Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, the Taoiseach has emphasised repeatedly that current restrictions will be in place for some time to come and that any easing of restrictions will be gradual, as happened following the first wave in 2020. Businesses in particular require certainty, even if it is a difficult certainty. That is why government supports for businesses will remain in place for the foreseeable future to offset the likelihood of ongoing restrictions. So happy to clarify that. Now, Paul Somerville and Colette Brown are still here. Just because I really wanted to get to, I know it's been a big talking point for a lot of people this week, is the story of GameStop. Paul, do people have it at this stage, or do we need to explain it a little bit to them?
No, I think actually it's been very poorly covered, especially in the papers today. And there's a misunderstanding about actually what's going on in the financial markets. This story is all about the plumbing of the financial system and how it works. Now, maybe we'll start with just GameStop and what has actually happened. And people will remember the movie The Big Short. Well, The Big Short was based on a guy called Michael Burry, who bet against the housing market in 2008 and made many, many millions, or maybe even hundreds of millions. He started buying shares in GameStop last August when GameStop shares were about $4. And what he said was, well, this company doesn't seem to be doing as badly as most people say it is doing, and I'm very happy to buy the shares. So what happened was a lot of retail investors who follow what he's saying, and they figured this out for themselves, started buying shares as well.
So there was value here.
They thought there was value in it. At $4 maybe value. You know, they thought maybe it might go to $5. So there was some value there and whatever. But then the most interesting part about it, what they recognised was this company had a lot of short selling in the shares. Now, that means there was people betting against the shares. There was about 60% of the share float was short. Now, that is unbelievable.
And just in English, what that means is that people who'd bet against the share, they were going to have to, if the share went up, they were going to have, they had borrowed shares effectively, so they were going to have to buy the share as it went up.
We'll get to that in a second.
Just
stick with it for the moment.
Okay, go on.
So what this group of investors said, well, if we were able to push up this share, these guys might have to buy their shares back. So what the group of investors, and this is where electronic platforms come in, because all these investors were talking to each other over a website called Wall Street Bets, and they were using Reddit. So they were all talking to each other saying, look, this looks like an unbelievable way to make some money. And they all started betting on it. So the share price went up from $4 to $70. Now, it's important to realise that all these guys were not just buying the shares, they were making very leveraged bets through the options market. So they were buying, making huge bets with small amounts of money.
So a guy who had 100 quid wasn't buying 100 quid's worth of shares. He was actually buying 1,000 quid's worth of shares.
So let me explain to you. Say, for an example, I went in to Paddy Power's and I said, look, I want to bet on Brighton beating Man United tomorrow 7-0. Paddy Power's all day would take that bet and say, thank you very much. Yeah, and they wouldn't do anything about it. We're watching the game and Brighton are winning 5-0 at half time. Paddy Power suddenly goes in and tries to hedge themselves in the marketplace. So this is what the options guys, who the guys who sell options, as the price goes up, they need to go into the share market and buy the shares also, creating a demand. So this is pushing up the shares. Now, unfortunately for, say, the retail investors, because just by the way, I know it's a story about David versus Goliath, but there is millions of hedge funds who are doing this as well. It is not a David versus Goliath and the hedge funds are on the wrong side of this trade. Some hedge funds are on the wrong side of this trade. Many more hedge funds are doing, the same thing. Okay, but what the retail investors do and what they've been using is a platform called Robinhood. Now, Robinhood is just a stockbroker account. It's a new app that you can do on your phone. And the difference between them and most stockbrokers is they offer free trading. So they've had about 15 to 20 million new customers last year of opened accounts with Robinhood. And what they do is they go in and just like a stockbroker, they press a button on their phone and they buy shares or leverage bets. Very important to say that these bets are leveraged, because how does Robinhood make their money? And most people didn't figure out how Robinhood makes its money. How does it make money if it gives out free trading? Well, what Robinhood does is it sells the information and sells all those orders to hedge funds and high frequency trading. And this is where it gets interesting, because this is a story about high frequency trading and how these companies operate. And just by the way, many of them have their headquarters in Dublin. So this is a very big Irish story rather than a story about the stock markets in America. So what happens then? These hedge funds and high frequency traders are buying the orders off Robinhood. Now, Robinhood's main client, so these guys who you're reading in the papers are fighting for the little man, whatever, these guys are making hedge funds an absolute fortune out of this situation. So I know it's reported that hedge funds are losing a lot of money. Some are. So earlier in the week, as the stock price went up, it went from $4 to $70 to $500, because there's not enough shares in the marketplace for people who are short to buy the shares back. So what happens next? Well, the share price keeps on going up until somebody does something about it. And the first thing that happened was a hedge fund went bust earlier in the week. Who bailed out the hedge fund? Citadel. Who is the biggest buyer of the orders off Robinhood? Citadel. Citadel is the biggest hedge fund. At the moment, Citadel control about 47% of all retail trading in American stocks, and about just over 20% of all retail trading. So Citadel has bailed out the hedge fund and put in its own money. Now, there's very questionable ethics going on here, which will be investigated, but what you've seen is not just in GameStop, but in other stocks. So any stock with a short interest that is high, the retail investors or traders have been pushing up those stocks for short, people who are short to buy back the stocks. Now, before you ask me another question, it's important, because
shorts, I don't lose people here either.
Short sellers have a very bad reputation, because it sounds like, oh, well, they're just betting on these companies going bust.
And we've been told that they can create narratives around companies that push them down as well.
Again, that is a misnomer. That is what some of them do. Most of them are they are long, short funds. So when they bet on one bad thing, they bet on one good thing. I'll give you an example. Say, for an example, I've got a lot of money and I want to bet on Irish banks. I believe AIB will outperform Bank of Ireland. What do? I buy AIB shares and I short Bank of Ireland shares. Why does that protect me? That protects me because if the market moves up or down, I don't care, so long as AIB outperforms Bank of Ireland.
Okay.
So what they're doing when they're betting against GameStop and all these stocks is they're buying other shares and they're saying these other shares will perform better than GameStop. It's very important, because that is why the market fell last week. The overall market fell because when they're buying back their GameStop shares, they must sell their other shares.
Right, okay. So, and what you're saying ultimately is that, like, the big market makers are still in charge and still running things, and they will always, the house always wins ultimately.
Well, when the people who are using Robinhood figure out that their orders don't go straight into an exchange, they're sold to a high frequency trader, I think they're going to be absolutely livid. For an example, like, I do online educational courses, and we covered this all about 4 months ago, saying there's going to be a big problem with Robinhood, because when the people who trade with Robinhood find out how it works, they are going to be up in arms, and that's exactly what's happening at the moment.
So they're patsies. Colette, can you give Talk some English here about what your view on this is.
Well, I think there was initially a David and Goliath aspect to it, because you had all these, you know, the little guys on Reddit, as it were, that people had mocked and kind of derided over the years, who were seen to be taking out. And they did take out at least one huge hedge fund that had obviously decided to short this company. But I think it shows the influence of new technology on, you know, Wall Street as an institution, which, you know, the name suggests that the trading is going on in this one designated area of, you know, one capital city in the world. Obviously, that isn't the case. And maybe there needs to be a lot of work there in terms of regulation to kind of catch up with the way technology has moved. But I think there were indications during the week that actually what we're hearing now, that, you know, the initial reporting about, you know, the kind of plucky small guys taking out the hedge funds, it wasn't really based in reality. If you looked at the figures, if you looked at the sales figures, even though there were some, you know, very eye-catching stories about one guy in particular on this subreddit who had invested $53,000 in these shares and saw them soar, you know, his investment to $11 million. Yeah. And I think he's recently had a baby and he was renting his house at the moment. So obviously he's in a pretty good financial position now.
If you got out, get out now. if you're listening, Redditors, get out now, because like always leave a bit for the next guy or leave a bit to go. I saw the Wolf of Wall Street on last night, and he said, look, you always want to get in at the end of the beginning and get out at the beginning of the end. And it sounds to me like it's the beginning of the end now. And
there is a game of chicken online at the moment with people trying to decide, you know, should they let the share go or not?
It's important to say that this isn't over at all, because this is going to happen in many other markets in the next weeks and months, especially they're looking at the silver market now. One thing I would like to
briefly,
say, it's very, very similar to 1998-99 is the Russian crisis, when long-term credit management blew up and nearly blew up the whole financial system
so
in 1998.
This is not just a laugh. This is
absolutely not. This is going to get way more serious.
Okay, Paul Somerville, CEO of Somerville Advisory Markets, and Colette Brown, Irish independent columnist and barrister. Thank you very much for that. So now, if you didn't think you understood the GameStop story, you understand it less now.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.